Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Center for Strategic and International Studies. My name is Andrew Schwartz, and I am our Vice President, our Senior Vice President of External Relations here at CSIS. It's my great pleasure today to introduce to you Mr. Richard Koo. Richard is the Chief Economist at Nomura Research Institute in Tokyo. A former advisor to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, Richard's been ranked the number one economist in Japan on three separate occasions by the Nikkei Financial Ranking. Richard will continue his day job at Nomura, but fortunately for CSIS, he's just joined us as a non-resident senior advisor. And at CSIS, we're acutely aware of the importance of economic vitality to national security and global stability. And we're very much looking forward to benefiting from Richard's wealth of knowledge and experience in improving Japan's banking system and helping guide that economy. His research on global financial markets will also help us to inform the economic components that underlie so many of the critical issues important to us here at CSIS. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, it's indeed my honor to welcome Mr. Richard Koo.
It's nice to be back here. I think the last time I spoke here was 2.5 years ago. And something that you guys did that I was not made aware of, one of my charts was put on the web, and that actually did had quite an impact on U.S. housing market. It's this chart, which shows what happened to Japanese house prices and U.S. house prices 15 years earlier. U.S. house prices and Japanese house prices 15 years earlier. And when I spoke here the last time, it was March of 2009. And by November 2009, I was speaking in Boston, and a bunch of real estate types during the seminar came up to me and said, "Do you know why U.S. Do you know why U.S. house prices stabilized here? So many people have seen this chart from a CSIS website and says, wow, Japanese house prices stabilized here. It's okay for U.S. to buy. So a lot of Americans bought houses here, and then that's how U.S. house prices stabilized." That's what these people told me. Well, I think those people are giving me far too much credit for this chart, but CSIS did have an impact on economic matters in a very serious way, because until U.S. house prices stabilize, nothing can move forward. Well, there's so much debate out there as to what is the right thing to do. You know, there are people who are saying, no, there should be more monetary stimulus to get the economy going. Other people say, no, there's too much monetary stimulus. That's treason to put in any more. Some people say, no, the fiscal stimulus, we have to build roads and bridges. And the others are saying, no, the big government is the problem of all, the source of all problems. Others are saying, what do we do with all these banking problems? Should they be writing off problem loans quickly? The others are saying, no, if you do it quickly, the whole thing will come crashing down. Problem with rating agencies, what to do with those guys? Are we supposed to keep zero interest rates, or the rates should be raised? All of these debate that is happening in the U.S., U.K., and many parts of Europe, all of that took place in Japan 10, 15 years ago. Every one of them. And it took us a long time to figure out that this was actually a different disease, something completely different from what we learn in universities, university economic classes, in that private sector is actually minimizing debt instead of maximizing profits. And all the economics we learn in universities are based on this one premise that private sector is maximizing profits. Well, if that assumption goes out the window, then you have to think something completely different to replace it. And so what happened in Japan, it took us a long time to figure out. Now, as you can see, the U.S. is going through the same process. This is what happened to the house prices exactly following the Japanese path. This is what happened on U.S. commercial real estate compared to the Japanese commercial real estate. Now, on the way up, of course, Japanese commercial real estate moved up faster, but on the way down, it's quite similar in magnitude and duration. And against this, central banks all around the world drop rates very sharply. in the case of the United States, to the level of the Japanese level for the last 3 years. But I would argue that the response of these lowering of interest rates have been remarkably muted. I used to run econometric models at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and what I remember was that U.S. economy is supposed to be very interest sensitive compared to continental European economies or the Japanese economy because of the flexibility of U.S. labor market. So Federal Reserve raises interest rates, economy responds. Federal Reserve lower interest rates, economy responds rather quickly. Based on that knowledge, the idea that unemployment rate in this country is still 9.0% with zero interest rates for almost full 3 years is an unthinkable development. If economy is that interest responsive and then U.S. interest rates are lowered to zero for 3 years, we should be seeing three or four bubbles by now. Unemployment rate possibly into 2% or even 1% range, not 9%. And industrial production, yes, it did return to the level of 2005 after the Lehman shock, but still long ways to go before reaching the previous peak. Same story in Europe. This is a Eurozone. Industrial production is back to the level of 2006, but unemployment rate still double digit. And even this chart is very misleading for Europe because if you look at individual countries, Germany has done very well. They actually reached the previous peak, 2008. But if you look at the level of industrial production in France, level 1999, Italy, 1994, Spain, 1997. They have so a long ways off from their previous peak. And it's not just industrial production or employment that are falling behind. If you look at money supply, situation is even bleaker. Now, many of you have heard that the Federal Reserve have dumped all these money, liquidity into the system, quantitative easing one, quantitative easing two, the operation twist. There's now talk of quantitative easing three, more liquidity in the system. And, of course, ECB, Bank of Japan also doing a lot of that. That gives a sense that there must be tons of money flooding in the markets. The inflation is just around the corner, and we have to be very careful. Well, if you look at the liquidity injected by the central bank, which is the red line, it is true that it went from 100 to almost 300, which means we should be having 300% unemployment, 300% inflation rate. But when you look at the indicator called money supply, that's the amount of money private sector gets to spend, or that's the money private sector has to spend. It hardly grew during this entire period. And if you look at this green line, which is the credit available to the private sector, it actually fell. With no growth in money supply, meaning private sector doesn't have that much more money to spend, and credit available to the private sector actually falling, there is no way economy is going to experience inflation or economic growth, certainly not from this end. And sure enough, this is an inflation rate. This is a consumer spending deflator. That's the indicator that Federal Reserve looks at, still staying at very low levels, in spite of liquidity in the system that should give us 300% inflation rate. And we all learn in universities, for those of you who took economics, that these three lines are supposed to move together. Right? If the central bank increases the reserve in the system by 10%, money supply should grow by 10%, credit available to the private sector should also increase by 10%. And that world did exist before the Lehman shock. Three lines moving beautifully together. But after the Lehman shock, all three are all over the map, meaning the traditional relationship has all gone haywire. And then you look at what happened in Europe, similar story. Reserves in the banking system was increased by the ECB, but money supply grew very, very slowly. Credit available to the private sector also grew very, very slowly. And this is the situation in the UK. Three lines moving together. And then once the credit Lehman shock hit, well, Bank of England increased reserves in the banking system massively. Now on this one, those of us from Japan have a little bit of Schadenfreude. What do I mean by Schadenfreude? Well, when Bank of England was increasing this quantitative easing, Bank of England Governor Marvin King said, we're not going to be like the Japanese. We're going to do this quickly. We're going to do this massively. We're going to get the money supply up, and then we're going to get the UK economy going. We're not going to be like the Japanese. And those of us in Japan said, okay, try it. See whether you can do any better. And sure enough, well, Bank of England certainly increased the reserves in the banking system massively, but look where the money supply is. This is the amount of money private sector gets to spend. And this green line is the credit available to the private sector actually shrinking. There's no way UK economy is going to grow with this kind of money supply growth. There's no way UK economy will experience inflation with this kind of money supply growth. And as we all know, they just went through a very ugly rioting not too long ago because people are so upset at the slowness of economic growth. And this is what we went through in Japan. I put October 1997 kind of arbitrarily here because that's when Japan started experiencing a banking crisis with Hokkaido Takushoku Bank failing and then Yamaichi Securities going under, Sanyo Securities going under. Now, if you from here, Bank of Japan increased liquidity in the system massively, but money supply grew very, very slowly. Credit available to the private sector actually shrunk. And as a result, we had no inflation in spite of this massive increasing monetary base. And instead of inflation, we were experiencing deflation at times. How do we end up in this kind of situation? Well, if you look at this in detail, this shows what happened to Japanese corporate demand for funds during this period. This is how much money companies raised from both the capital market and the banking system throughout this period. And if you look at the bubble period from 1986 to the year 1999, you see demand for funds increasing very sharply. So people are borrowing all sorts of money, investing in all sorts of assets. And because the economy was doing very well, Bank of Japan was raising short-term interest rates quite rapidly, all the way to 8% when the inflation rate was only around 3%. Then the bubble burst, and you see demand for funds falling very, very sharply. Bank of Japan realizing the economy is weakening, dropped rates from 8% to almost zero by 1995, and look what happens afterwards. It goes into negative. Negative means companies are paying down debt with zero interest rates. We never learned this in universities, right? Companies are not supposed to pay down debt when interest rates are zero. They're supposed to be borrowing and investing money. If companies pay down debt with zero interest rates, that means corporate presidents are so stupid, they can't find good use of the money even with zero interest rates. And if that's the case, those companies should just dissolve themselves, give the money back to the shareholders so the shareholders can find something interesting to do with those funds. But in Japan, that lasted for full 10 years, from 1995 to 2005 and 2006. Why? Did all the Japanese corporate executives went crazy? Not quite. In fact, this is happening all over the world today. Companies deleveraging when interest rates are at zero or near zero. And this is happening because all the assets they bought during the bubble days, asset prices collapsed, but the liabilities remained. So they're actually underwater. The balance sheet's underwater. They're bankrupt. Now, bankrupt means these guys should just leave the scene, but when you think about it, there are actually two types of bankruptcies. The usual type is that whatever the cars or cameras these companies brought to the market were not valued by the society. The company tried to sell these with more advertising expenditures, still to no avail. Eventually, they go bankrupt. In that case, there's nothing more you can do about it. But there's another type of bankruptcy, and that is that cars and cameras are still selling very well, but their balance sheets, the company's balance sheet is underwater because of silly decisions they made during the bubble days. In that case, what is the right thing to do? You still have cash flow, but your balance sheet is underwater. What is the right thing to do? Well, it doesn't matter whether you're Japanese or German or Taiwanese or whatever. The right thing to do is to use the cash flow to pay down debt. Because that way you don't have to tell your shareholders, sorry, it's all piece of paper now. You don't have to tell your bankers it's all non-performing loans. And most importantly, you don't have to tell your workers that you have no more jobs tomorrow. So for all the stakeholders involved, that's the right thing to do. Use the cash flow to pay down debt. And since asset prices never go negative, if you continue to pay down debt, at some point, your balance sheets will be balanced again, and you say, phew, I'm out of this problem, you can move forward. That's the right thing to do at the micro level. But when everybody does it all at the same time at the macro level, we have a problem. Because in a national economy, if someone is saving money or paying down debt, you better have someone on the other side borrowing and spending money. In the usual economy, if there's someone borrowing, someone saving money or paying down debt on this side, there are people, so-called financial types, people like us, myself, who will take the money from this side and give it to someone who can use it on the other side, and that person borrows and spends it, and so all the saved funds are eventually borrowed and spent. And if there are too many borrowers, rates are raised. Too few borrowers, interest rates are lowered. Make sure that all the saved funds are borrowed and spent. But in this world, where private sector as a whole is deleveraging, minimizing debt, and these people are basically faced with balance sheets underwater, they're bankrupt. So even at zero interest rates, these people are not going to borrow money, and there won't be very many lenders to these guys either, especially when the lenders know that borrowers are bankrupt. And often it's the lenders themselves who are bankrupt. So in this situation, something really troubling happens, and that is that in a usual economy, and if I'm a member of the household sector, I have $1,000 of income, I spend $900 myself and decide to save $100. $900 is already someone else's income. That's not a problem. And this $100 that I decide to save will go through financial types who will then give it to someone else who can use it. That person borrows and spends it. Then $900 plus $100 against the original $1,000 of income, the economy moves forward. Too few borrowers, rates are lowered. Too few borrowers, rates are lowered. Too many borrowers, rates are raised to make sure that all the saved funds are borrowed and spent. But in this world, where private sector is deleveraging even with zero interest rates, you bring interest rates down to zero, there's still no borrowers. Everybody's still paying down debt. Then what happens? $1,000 of income I have, spend $900, decide to save $100. That $100 gets stuck in a banking system. It can't move out because private sector sorts are all paying down debt. Then the economy shrinks from $1,000 to $900 because only $900 are spent. Now, the $900 is someone else's income. If that person borrows and that person gets the $900, and if that person decides that, okay, I have $900, let's save 10%. So he spends $810, decide to save $90. That $90 gets stuck in a banking system because this process goes on for 10 years. Then if you do nothing to this situation, the economy shrinks from 1,900, 810, 730 very, very quickly, even with zero interest rates. And you said, did anything like this ever happen before? Well, when you look at what happened during the Great Depression, that was the mechanism. Everybody was paying down debt. No one was borrowing money. And the economy shrunk from 1,900, 810, 730. United States lost 46% of its GDP in just 4 years, from 1929 to 1933. And that's when share prices fell to 1/8 of the peak value. Now, Japan went something close to it. What happened to Japan? And if you look at some of the debt repayment in these periods, it is over 30 trillion yen a year. 30 trillion yen, 6% of Japan's GDP. And that's just the corporate debt repayment. On top of this, as you know, Japanese households, or I should say Japanese housewives, love to save money. So if that was 4% of GDP, and this is 6% of GDP, Japan could have lost 10% of GDP every year. That would have been exactly like what happened to the United States during the Great Depression. Then you look at what happened to Japan's GDP. This is the Japanese GDP, both in nominal and real terms. And the purple line here, this Mount Fuji thing, is the Japanese commercial real estate. And when commercial real estate prices were skyrocketing, when Japan was in a bubble, people felt rich, spent a lot of money, GDP went up. That's no-brainer. During the bubble, people feel rich, spend a lot of money, GDP goes up. Anyone can explain that one. But what's remarkable about the Japanese experience is what happened afterwards. Commercial real estate prices start collapsing, and it collapses down 87% nationwide. Now, try to imagine Washington prices down 87, New York down 87. San Francisco down 87. Chicago down 87. What kind of economy do you think you have left here? Right? Then you look at the Japanese GDP throughout this period, both in nominal and real terms. It never fell below the peak of the bubble. Peak of the bubble is this line. It was always above the peak of the bubble. With 87 decline in asset values nationwide, the entire private sector paying down debt like crazy, Japan managed to keep its GDP up for the entire period. How did it do that? Very simply, government borrow and spend it. Government borrowed $100 and spent it. Then it's $900 plus $100,000 against the original income of $1,000. There's no reason for GDP to fall. The following year, the same thing happens. Household saving money, companies not borrowing money. Why same thing happens year after year after year? Well, if asset prices fall 87%, 1 or 2 years of debt repayment is not enough. Some companies may take 5 years, others may take 10. If you're unlucky enough to have bought at the peak, it may take 20 years before your balance sheet is repaired. So all these companies are paying down debt. And at that time, Japanese government was run by this group called Liberal Democrats, highly liberal with public spending. So as soon as the economy began to weaken, these guys said, oh, let's build roads and bridges, kept on borrowing and spending money. As a result, we have this chart known in Japan as alligator's mouth. So this is the tax revenue and government spending. And for some reason, this alligator's mouth doesn't close. Now, tax revenue fell even with the GDP staying above the peak of the bubble because there were some tax cuts, and of course, asset prices dropped so sharply. And government kept on increasing spending. The gap between the two, of course, is the budget deficit. And if you add all the deficit together, so the area between these two lines from 1990 to 2005, I put 2005 because 2005 is when corporate debt repayment finally stopped. This 15-year period, you add them all together, it adds up to 460 trillion yen, 92% of Japan's GDP. It's a huge sum of money, but I would argue that this was a money very well spent. Because when you go back to this chart and try to imagine what might have happened to Japan's GDP without this government action, chances are high that Japan's GDP would have collapsed. And as I indicated to you earlier, U.S. lost 46% of its GDP. And at that time, the damage to the U.S. balance sheets, U.S. private sector balance sheets, as a result of fall in share prices to 1/8 of the peak value was equivalent to 1 year's worth of 1929 GDP. The amount of wealth Japanese lost as a result of the bursting of the bubble was equivalent to 3 years' worth of 1989 GDP. So Japanese damage was to its balance sheets were three times bigger than what happened in the United States, the loss of national wealth as a percentage of GDP. So Japanese GDP should have fallen more than 46%, but that's too much even for my own blood. So I just drew a line here, penciled in this line, assuming that GDP would have fallen to the level before the bubble. And the bubble started something around 1986, so I just brought the level down to 1980, this line to where GDP was in 1985. Now, this is still a pretty optimistic scenario. If you compare this line with the actual GDP over a 15-year period, it's over 2,000 trillion. So basically, Japan spent 460 trillion and bought the GDP equivalent to 2,000 trillion. That's a pretty good deal. That's why I said this was one of the most effective economic policy in history. Somehow people don't hear it this way because these journalists who reported on Japan over the last 20 years somehow assumed that even with government taking no action, GDP would have stayed at the top of the bubble. But that's impossible for a country experiencing 87% decline in commercial real estate and everybody in the private sector paying down debt. So you have to really measure from this line. And if you measure from this line, then you realize you can see how effective this fiscal policy was. So first lesson from the Japanese experience was that if you have a huge bubble bursting, if you put in the fiscal stimulus from the very beginning and keep it there, you can actually maintain the living standard of the people, allow private sector to pay down debt because private sector has the income to pay down debt, and if you keep it long enough, private sector will eventually come out of this debt repayment mode, and then you go on to fix your government balance sheets. That's basically the first lesson. Well, how much of this is learned in the G20 framework? Well, actually, this was the chart the Prime Minister also used to convince the other 80 members in G20 meeting held here in Washington, November 2008, 2 months after the Lehman shock. And he was able to convince G20 to agree to fiscal stimulus. And so 2009, all the countries put in fiscal stimulus, not just Japan, but US, UK, Germany, everybody put in the fiscal stimulus. And that's how the collapse from the Lehman shock was arrested and the economy saw some recovery, as you saw earlier. So that was good. That Japanese lesson was learned. You put in a fiscal stimulus when you have this kind of situation. Happy ending. Well, not quite. There were actually two parts to the Japanese lesson. And this is the first part. What's the second part? Well, if you look at this very carefully, you notice that there are two bouts of negative growth here, 1997 and 2001. Well, how did we get negative growth in Japan on these two occasions? Well, if you're sitting in Washington and then look at Japan, you say, 1997, that's Asian currency crisis. 2001, the bursting of the dot-com bubble. Not quite. If you're in Japan and you're facing 1997, that's when Prime Minister Hashimoto tried to put in the austerity fiscal consolidation. And at that time, I spoke out loudly against the Prime Minister, saying, if you try to cut budget deficit, now the whole thing will come crashing down. But I was just a private sector economist, not even Japanese. All these big shots from around the world, particularly the IMF and the OECD, those people who know nothing about anything, told Japan that, are you building bridges to nowhere, roads to nowhere, you have aging of population, you're not getting any bang for the money, because they were kind of assuming that even without the fiscal stimulus, Japanese GDP would be somewhere here. So all these big shots from around the world, as well as Ministry of Finance officials in Japan, said cut, cut, cut. So Prime Minister cut. Well, we have 5 quarters of negative growth, complete breakdown in the banking system, and a budget deficit, instead of shrinking by 15 trillion, which was the original plan, it increased by 16 trillion, 68%. It took Japan 10 years to climb out of this mistake. This is a chart. The purple areas are the budget deficit, and the white areas are the tax receipts. And 1997 is here. Economy collapsed, so tax receipts fell, budget deficit increased. 2001 was a much more smaller austerity measure. Prime Minister Koizumi trying to limit issuance of Japanese government bonds to 30 trillion yen, but that was not enough to offset all the private sector deleveraging. And on top of that, of course, there was a bursting of the dot-com bubble. So budget deficit, tax receipts fell, budget deficit increased. And it took 10 years for Japan to climb out of this mistake. That's why Japan took 15 years to climb out of what I call balance sheet recession. Well, how much of this lesson is understood around the world? And I must say, next to nothing. Because you know the debate in this town, debate in London, in Brussels, in Madrid, everywhere around the world, people are talking about austerity, cutting budget deficit, not leaving debt to the children. Now, that's all great if private sector is maximizing profits. If private sector is healthy, private sector balance sheets are in good shape, and private sector is trying to borrow money, then government should be cutting budget deficit, especially when the deficit is so large. But that's simply not the case around the world today. This is the United States. Now, this is a rather messy chart. Let me explain how this chart is put together. This is taken from a data called flow of funds. And the flow of funds data shows who is borrowing money and who is saving money in each of these economies. So this is the United States. There's a horizontal line going across a zero. Above zero, they call it financial surplus, are the people who are saving money. And below zero, financial deficit, this word is kind of unfortunate, but financial deficit means people who are borrowing and investing money. And there are four lines here. Corporate sector, general government sector, household sector, and the rest of the world. If you add the four lines together, you're supposed to get zero. That's how this chart is put together. So in each of these years, you can tell, okay, which part of the U.S. economy was saving money and which part of the U.S. economy was borrowing and investing money. Now, if you look at the bubble days, both the red line, which is the household line, and the heavy blue line, corporate line, were way below zero, which means everybody was borrowing and investing money. But where are we now? Both lines are above zero. In fact, household line way above zero, corporate line still way above zero. Now, this is happening with zero interest rates. So this is exactly the Japanese situation you saw a little earlier, that even with zero interest rates, people are increasing savings or paying down debt. If you measure from the peak of the bubble, fourth quarter 2006, to the most present period, the increase in private sector savings in the United States, meaning the addition of this dotted red line and a heavy blue line, corporate line and household line together, is 9.3% of U.S. GDP, a massive increase in private sector savings. United States is no longer low savings country. Savings like crazy. I mean, both lines above zero means the entire private sector is saving money or paying down debt, which is the same thing. Now, against that, this huge increase in savings, U.S. government increased budget deficit here, this green line, and this from here to here is 5.8% of U.S. GDP. So private sector increased savings to the tune of 9.3% of GDP. Of that increase in savings, government took 5.8% worth and brought it back to the income stream. But that's still not enough to offset all the increase in private sector savings. And that's the reason, I'm afraid, U.S. economy is not doing particularly well today. That's why unemployment rate is still 9%. So I would argue that, yes, budget deficit in the United States is large, but not large enough to offset what's being happening to the private sector. But for some reason, everybody's just looking at the size of the budget deficit and getting all upset. So, wow, the budget deficit in the U.S., 9% of GDP, this is terrible, horrible. But when you look at what's been happening to the private sector, even the current budget deficit, in my view, is not large enough to stabilize the U.S. economy. Same thing is happening in the U.K. During the bubble days, households in the U.K. were borrowing huge sum of money. Now households are above zero. And corporate line, which was about zero to begin with, now even more so. And if you add the corporate line and the household lines to get lines together, it's increase in savings to the tune of 8.2% of UK GDP. Against that, UK government increased budget deficit to the tune of 7.1% of GDP, but that's not large enough to offset what's been happening to its private sector. So even in the UK, I would argue that, yes, the budget deficit is large, but not large enough to offset what's been happening to its private sector. As a result of this massive deleveraging in both the UK and US private sectors, this is what happened to the interest rates. This is 10-year government bond yields. And during the bubble days, UK, US, Swedish bond yields were very high, 4 to 5%, while Japanese yields were less than 2%. But look where we are now, very close to Japanese levels. In fact, US and UK bond yields today are where Japanese bond yields were in 1997. And the gap between the two yields, the Japanese yield and US, UK, Swedish yields, which used to be over 3%, are now just over 1%. And that's one of the reasons why Japanese yen has become so strong. Because earlier, with an interest gap of 3%, a lot of money was leaving Japan into those markets. Now people are saying it's not interesting anymore, and the money is flowing back to the Japanese market, which is why Japanese yen has gained so much since the Lehman shock. The fact that bond yields have come down to such low levels, and a lot of people out there said, oh, this is just a bubble. The bond yield can go crazy next day. And people call it a bond market bubble and so forth. I would say there's no bubble in the bond market. This is what you expect in a balance sheet recession, where private sector is minimizing debt instead of maximizing profits. Because when you think about it, If you are a fund manager in the U.S., U.K., or Japan, and if you're hedge funds, you can do anything you want, but suppose you are managing these public funds, pension money, and so forth, you cannot take foreign exchange risk. You want some sort of a principal guarantee, which means you want to invest in bonds instead of equities. And if the private sector is continue to delever, if all three things are together, the only thing you can buy is the government bond, right? If you want principal guarantee, that means you cannot buy equities, stocks, you cannot buy commodities, you cannot buy oil or pork barrel, whatever. If you cannot take foreign exchange risk, then you cannot put money outside the country. So if you have to stay in the dollar, and you cannot buy anything without principal guarantee, and if the private sector is no longer borrowing money, the only thing you can buy is government bond. And so, once you are in what I call balance sheet recession, bond yields come down to ridiculously low levels. And that was first proven in Japan 10, 15 years ago, and now happening in all of these economies, because that's exactly the same mechanism. And in the Japanese case, a lot of American hedge funds have nothing better to do, try to short the JGB market and destroy the Japanese government bond market. Well, they tried it many times. All of them failed, because this what happens during balance sheet recession is fundamental to the economy. That is to say, the money has to go to the Japanese government bond because these investors have no other choice. And that's now happening in the U.S., happening in the U.K., Sweden, these economies. So I would argue that there is no sovereign debt crisis, because these economies with huge budget deficit, and in the case of U.S. and U.K., huge current account deficit on top, have seen bond yields coming down to Japanese levels. Then you look at the Euroland or Eurozone. This is what's happening to the Eurozone bond yields. And German yields have come down to the levels of U.S. and U.K., but all other yields are all over the map. Some of them, like in Greece, nearly 26%. Now, why are we seeing this development in the Eurozone while all the other countries with similarly large budget deficit, similarly large current account deficits, are bond yields coming down to such low levels? Well, first of all, we have to check whether the Eurozone is in balance sheet recession. And this is the flow of funds for the Eurozone. And you see that Eurozone is clearly in balance sheet recession. Corporate line is about zero. Household line is also about zero. Two together, way about zero here. And yes, the budget deficit in Eurozone have increased, but private sector savings have also increased massively. And if you look at individual countries, this is Spain. During the bubble days, both the household line and the corporate line were well below zero, meaning everybody was borrowing and investing in all sorts of assets. Now they are both well above zero. In fact, the jump from third quarter of 2007 to the most present period, Spanish private sector increased savings to the tune of 18% of Spanish GDP, which means if nothing's done to this situation, Spanish GDP would have shrunk by 18%. That's how much Spanish private sector increased savings. And against that, Spanish government, which was running budget surplus during the bubble days, increased deficit massively to take the money stuck in the financial system and then put it back into the income stream. This was about 12% of Spanish GDP. But against this 12%, private sector increased savings to the tune of 18%. It's nowhere near enough to offset what's happening to the private sector savings. As a result, Spanish unemployment rate is over 21% today. And the youth unemployment rate is over 45% today. So Great Depression scenario right there. And if you look at Ireland, same situation, even worse. If you compare, look at what happened to private sector savings from 2007, Irish private sector increased savings to the tune of nearly 22% of GDP. And against that, government increased deficit to the tune of about 17% of GDP, not enough to offset what's been happening to the private sector. As a result, Irish GDP is already down 10% from the peak in real terms, 20% down from peak in nominal terms. It's a horrible situation. This is Portugal, similar story. There's huge increase in savings compared to the bubble days. Now, in the Portugal case, unfortunately, the corporate line is still below zero, but household line is way above zero. And this shift from second quarter 2008 to the most present period, 8.6% of our Portuguese GDP, a huge increase in private sector savings. Now, looking at these, we should expect Spanish GDP, Spanish bond yields to come down, Irish bond yields to come down, Portuguese bond yields to come down, because there's so much more savings generated in these economies than just a couple of years ago. But as you saw earlier, that's not happening. Why is it not happening? The bond yields in Spain, bond yields in Ireland should be down to the level of US and UK, or it could be even lower, because the increase in savings in Spain is even bigger than the increase in savings that we saw in the US and UK. Why is the Spanish bond yields not coming down to much lower levels? Here, we enter a very special world of Eurozone. And the problem that they are facing now can only happen in Eurozone. So let me explain. I told you earlier that if you are Japanese fund manager, or if you're a UK fund manager, or if you're a US fund manager, and if you have to invest in assets with no foreign exchange risk, principal guarantee, and if the private sector is deleveraging, you can only buy your government bond. But in the Eurozone, if you're a Spanish fund manager, if you're a Portuguese fund manager, a Greek fund manager, you don't have to buy your government bond. You can buy German government bond. You can buy Dutch government bond. And this is basically what's causing all the our problems in Eurozone today. Under usual balance sheet recession, I mean, balance sheet recession is a very unusual phenomenon, but in the usual balance sheet recession, ordinary balance sheet recession, bond yields has to come down, and that's the market's way of telling the government that this is no time to cut budget deficit. This is the time to increase budget deficit to get the economy going, allow private sector to have the income to pay down debt. That's the market's message. But in the Eurozone countries, the money can shift out. And so even though in Spain, for example, there's a huge increase in Spanish savings here, that comes into the Spanish fund managers. But Spanish fund managers getting this money say, wow, Spanish budget deficit is so large, I don't want to invest in this thing. So they put the money to German bonds or Dutch paper. Now, if the money that's coming into Holland or to Germany are actively utilized by German government or the Dutch government, they increase their fiscal spending, and then German economy does better, Dutch economy does better, and as a result, the rich Germans then take vacation in Spain, and then the GDP in Spain goes up, then it'll be fine. But what are the German government doing? What is German government doing? What is Dutch government doing? They're all trying to cut budget deficit. So the money goes into those markets, but they're not utilizing those markets. So the whole Eurozone end up shrinking. So in Spain, when the money is needed, because Spain is obviously in balance sheet recession, government must increase spending to keep the GDP from collapsing, unemployment from getting worse. They cannot get the money because bond yields have been rising, which is a kind of viewed as a warning from the market that you cannot large budget deficit. Government panics, try to cut budget deficit. But if the government tries to cut budget deficit when the private sector is deleveraging, economy gets worse and worse and worse. And when it gets worse, people panic even further. They say, oh my gosh, we have to cut budget deficit even more. And the situation just gets worse and worse and worse. That's basically the European situation at the moment. Now, this is exact opposite of what was happening just 5-6 years ago. 5-6 years ago, what was happening? Well, all these bankers in France, Germany, facing very low yields on their bonds, on their assets, said, oh my gosh, if I invest in Spanish paper, if I invest in French paper, if I invest in Greek paper, we get much higher yields. And you still don't have to incur foreign exchange risk. You still got principal guarantee because these are all government bonds. So that's when the 5-6 years ago, the flow was just the opposite. Huge flow out of Germany, France, or Holland into Spain, Greece, Portugal, and these economies. Now, at that time, why were those economies offering higher yields? Because they had a bubble. And if you were Spanish government official at the time, or the Irish government official at the time, you don't want this money coming from Germany and France, because that makes your bubble even worse. But you couldn't stop it because there are no capital controls inside the Eurozone. So the money comes in, the bubble gets worse, and bubble gets worse, more money comes in, the bubble gets worse still. Once the bubble bursts, those economies that are in balance sheet recession who need the money cannot get it, even though those monies were actually generated in those economies, because they all flow to German and Dutch paper. So that's the Eurozone problem we are faced with today. This crazy flow of funds that only happens in the Eurozone. So how do we get out of this mess? Well, one of my suggestions is that perhaps Eurozone economies should introduce a new rule. And the rules should say that member countries in the Eurozone can issue government bonds only to its own citizens. That German government bonds can be only purchased by German citizens. Spanish paper can only be purchased by Spanish citizens. Portuguese paper only purchased by Portuguese people. Now, some of you look, Richard Gugan crazy? Well, when you think about it, think it through. This is what was missing all along. Euro is an artificially created currency zone. And in order to make this thing work, artificial restrictions were necessary. And the people who put together the Maastricht Treaty, which is behind this Eurozone, came up with this idea of 3% limit on budget deficit. Of course, that limit was not followed by many countries, including Germany and France a couple of years ago. But when the Maastricht Treaty was put together, balance sheet recession, the concept of balance sheet recession did not exist in Europe. It only existed in Japan. And so the whole program was put together, the Maastricht Treaty was put together on the assumption that private sector is always forward-looking, private sector's balance sheets are always clean, and they're always private sector is maximizing profits. If that's the case, then 3% limit on budget deficit may be the right way to go. But now Eurozone, so many countries in the Eurozone, as you saw earlier, are in balance sheet recession. Private sector is no longer maximizing profits, even with zero interest rates or near zero interest rates. And in order to stabilize those economies, as I told you earlier, you do need large fiscal stimulus to offset it. But if you're limited to 3% of GDP, naturally you cannot put in the necessary fiscal stimulus. Economy gets worse and worse and worse, and the situation just goes completely out of control. So if this rule were in place year 2000, then Greeks couldn't have done what it did, and the Spanish budget deficit problem would not have gone to the kind of level we are experiencing today. But because no one talked about the possibility of balance sheet recession when Maastricht Treaty were being negotiated, unfortunately, Euro was introduced without this provision and ran for more than 11 years. So today, there's so much of the legacy of this Euro running without this provision. And as a result, we cannot possibly introduce this rule tomorrow because so many countries, the debt are now owned by foreigners. So what I propose to do would be that today, as soon as possible, these countries should announce that 10 years from now, we will introduce this rule. And from now to that 10 years or 7 years or whatever the case may be, that's the time that people should put in all sorts of bridging finance to get the to clean up the houses so that economies 10 years from now will be able to introduce that rule. And once this rule is introduced, the kind of problem we are experiencing now will never happen again. Because if the government cannot convince its own citizens that large budget deficit is necessary, that government will not be able to run a large budget deficit. And by making all these fiscal issues internal to individual countries, whatever happens to one fiscal jurisdiction will no longer affect the Eurozone as a whole. If Greek government defaults, only Greek people will be hurt. If some other government defaults, only those people are hurt. It's not a Eurozone problem anymore, which means European Central Bank can concentrate on running monetary policy instead of taking the fire extinguisher and going to one country and put out the fire there, and the next week is some other country going crazy, and then you put off the fire there. That's basically what's been happening in the Eurozone for the last three years. Those can all be put to rest once this rule is introduced. And this rule also allows flexibility as well as discipline. Flexibility in the sense that if you could convince the people that, look, we are in balance sheet recession, the government has to run large budget deficit to stabilize the economy, allow private sector to repair its balance sheets, then we can move forward. And if the people agreed, they will be able to run larger budget deficit. So it will make Maastricht Treaty applicable to both the usual, the textbook world, as well as the balance sheet recession world.
Oh, I was going to say, Richard, I know that we have a lot of questions.
Yes, of course.
Okay, great.
So I think this is the kind of end game that is necessary in Eurozone. It will take a lot of work to get there, of course, because unless EU, ECB, or IMF, those supranational institutions come up with these proposals, individual countries can do nothing. Maybe if Spanish government tomorrow says, oh, we're in balance sheet recession, we're going to increase budget deficit, all the money will leave Spain in 2 seconds, and then the whole country will come crashing down. So it has to be blessed by the international organizations. It has to be an agreement. And there should be a support coming from international organizations for the next 5 or 10 years that is necessary to bring where Eurozone is today to where they should be with this new rule. And in the meantime, EFSF, ECB, they will have to do everything they can to make sure that nothing falls apart between now and when these rules are actually operative. So that's what I see necessary for the Eurozone. Now, Eurozone also has banking problems. And what I call balance sheet recession is a borrower's problem. And what people call financial crisis is the lender's problem. And for that, the current proposals that are on the table, I find to be totally insufficient. Too naive is the word. Because if you have a systemic banking crisis the way European banks are facing at the moment, capital injection by the government should be the first resort, not the last resort. And the current proposal says that if all the attempt by the individual banks to raise capital fails, then the government will put in the capital sometime before June of next year. But the crisis is with us now. Government injection of capital should be the first resort, and the capital should be injected with minimum of conditions and at low cost as possible. Because if you put in all sorts of conditions, that there should be a limit on executive pay, dividend restrictions, this and this and that, the bankers will say, well, if it's too much trouble, we're not going to take the money. We just cut our assets. But if all banks cut assets all at the same time, the credit crunch will get so much worse. European economy will go down the drain much faster. And so when you're faced with these issues where banks are in sad shape,
But all banks have the same problem at the same time. You have to fix the credit crunch first. And after credit crunch is resolved, then you go after the individual bankers, not the other way around. If you go after individual bankers, and the bankers become even more defensive, and when all banks have the same problem at the same time, the economy collapses, and then you are far worse off than where you begin. So that's what I like to see happen in the Eurozone on the banking side. That is, say, they should put capital injection as the first resort with minimum conditions, lowest possible cost to the bankers. And on the balance sheet recession side, this end game of individual countries allowed to issue government bonds only to its own people. Once that end game is clearly stated, then what's left is just this bridge financing between now and we were able to introduce these rules. Finally, how about the United States? Well, I was hearing this morning some very sad stories about the current state of affairs in Congress, that Obama administration is already on the campaign mode and Republicans and Democrats are not working together. That's very, very sad. But that's what Japan went through as well. And I must say that it's very difficult to maintain fiscal stimulus in a democracy during peacetime. If there's a war going on and the enemy planes dropping bombs over your head, then, of course, you know exactly what how the money should be spent. People will be making guns and fighter planes and battleships. And then you come out of these recessions very quickly. And if you're a dictator and you know exactly what to do and you just keep your fiscal stimulus in place, someone complains, grab him, put him in jail, that's the end of the story, then you come out of these things also very quickly. And it's no coincidence that China is doing very well on this account. They are maintaining the fiscal stimulus. And when China put in the fiscal stimulus November 2008, the 4 trillion renminbi package, and when China said, we're going to maintain 8% growth, the whole world was laughing. No way China can maintain 8% growth. 12 months later, they were running 12% growth. Nobody was laughing. So if you're a dictator, you can maintain these things. And the worst case of this is, of course, what Hitler did from 1933 to 1938. When Hitler took over in 1933, German unemployment rate was 28%. People were literally starving to death. 5 years later, 1938, German unemployment rate was only 2. Whereas all the other countries, the democracies around, Poland, UK, France, they had nearly double-digit unemployment rate. And that gave Hitler a sense that, hey, maybe this time I can win the war. And I think that's how World War II basically started. And so this has a huge national security implications as well, that in this type of environment, dictators following the right economic policies come out of these recessions faster, stronger, and democracies tend to go back and forth between different types. So, no, cut the budget deficit. Oh, no, we spend more. No, you cannot use grandchildren's credit card, but we have to spend more. You know, go back and forth. And that's why these things typically take much longer. During the Japanese recession, I sometimes wish that I had some telephone number of North Korean general, call him up and send a few missiles over. And then the Japanese would be all digging the air raid shelters, and then Japan could have come out of these things much faster. Unfortunately, I didn't speak Korean, and I didn't have those telephone numbers. But that's the nature of the problem. It's very difficult to maintain fiscal stimulus in a democracy during peacetime. And Mr. President Obama is finding that out. Mr. Gordon Brown, the UK Prime Minister, found that out in a very sad way. And many of the LDP politicians in Japan also face the same problem. And what is even sadder is that if you put in the necessary fiscal stimulus and you avoid the crisis, you get bashed, right? Because you spend all this money, and then the economy didn't collapse. People said, God, you spent all this money, nothing happened. You must have wasted this money on some of the most useless projects on earth. And these journalists had nothing better to do, go around the country with a microscope and find a few roads to nowhere, some bridges to nowhere, and they make a big issue out of it. So I'm afraid this is going to be a long battle. I really wish, though, that President Obama would come out and explain this, 1,900, 810, 730 process to the American people. If he succeeds, if he succeeds in convincing just 10% of American population to move to a different camp, then we should be able to have fiscal stimulus. We should be able to maintain growth and pull the U.S. economy out of this mess. Well, I tried to convince some of the White House staffers to tell the president that this is what he should do, but unfortunately it hasn't happened to this date. But I'm happy to tell you that Federal Reserve Chairman, Chairman Bernanke, fully understands this mechanism and this risk. And you might have noticed that even though Chairman Bernanke used to be a champion of monetary policy, in the last 2 years, every time he's asked, he says, this is no time to cut budget deficit, because he understands that in this kind of environment, if the government cuts budget deficit, when private sector is deleveraging too, the whole thing will come crashing down. And so at least in the U.S., we have Chairman Bernanke. And people like Mr. Gene Sperling, he's also talking about maintaining fiscal stimulus. So in the U.S., my sense is that if things really go bad, those people who understand this thing will speak up, and then there might be some bounce back. But after bouncing back and the economy starts looking good, of course, the other types will come on. They cut budget deficit, and then we go down again. And so chances are high that we end up in some sort of a zigzag. That's basically the Japanese story for the previous 15 years. But in the case of Europe, nobody is talking about maintain fiscal stimulus. Our new ECB governor, Mr. Draghi, Mr. Trichet, Marvin King of Bank of England, all talking about cutting budget deficit when their economies are all in balance sheet recessions. So in the case of Europe, I'm afraid the line could be like this instead of a zigzag. So it's not the pretty picture, I'm afraid, but if we can only make 10% of the people understand this point and think that, oh, maybe fiscal policy has a role to play when private sector is minimizing debt. And private sector doesn't minimize debt very often. That's why this is not discussed in economics in the universities. But once every several decades, when private sector goes crazy over some bubble and the bubble bursts, then private sector end up minimizing debt. And then we fall into what I call balance sheet recession. Now, you may wonder, so how are we going to pay this debt back? Well, my sense is that this kind of recession will not happen again for at least 30 or 40 years. Because for the next one to happen, we have to be all dead first. Right? As long as we're alive, we're not going to make the same mistake. So when we are all dead, the next one happens. So we have at least 30 years or so to fix government balance sheets. And I think if you give 20, 30 years, I'm sure we can fix government finances, whether it's in Japan or in the U.S. But if you try to fix everything in 10 years' time, of course, it's not going to happen, especially in Japan with the budget public debt 230% of GDP. But if you give Japan 20 or 30 years, maybe it is possible. So I'm afraid that's the kind of time frame we have to be discussing when we are faced with this kind of disease. Thank you very much.
That was all great news. We have time for a few questions, and I know Mr. Koo can stay after for a few minutes as well. So can we take some questions from the audience? Yeah, right here.
Hi, Daniel Lakin from the Korea Economic Institute. You mentioned several times that now is not the time to be cutting budget deficits in any of the economies around the world. Of course, what you see in the news a lot these days is the super committee and debate over cutting the U.S. budget deficit. Now, so are you with the view that, like, how much would a potential deal coming out of the super committee hurt U.S. prospects for growth? Are we completely in the wrong track? Is How does that fit into your what you said earlier in your talk? Thank you.
Well, if they talk about long-term gradual correction of, for example, entitlements and things like that, that has nothing to do with the cyclical recession. I think people should be talking about how to limit entitlements from growing out of control. Those discussions are okay. But right now is no time to cut. And in that sense, this super committee, the very existence of super committee, in my view, is not appropriate, if I may put it that way. Instead, they should be thinking, okay, if we do have to spend this kind of money, what are the best projects that we can spend these money on? I think that's where the emphasis should be, instead of just trying to cut at any cost.
Is this working? Yes. Thank you very much for your presentation. It was extremely depth. But my question is about the European process. How can you manage to find any possibility of having this restriction of the bonds emitting to the population of the state when everybody in Europe is thinking that more integration is the solution?
Well, in the ideal world, fiscal consolidation, fiscal integration, unification, that's the ideal solution. So you have a monetary integration and a fiscal integration, the whole country operates just like in the United States. But I think fiscal integration is far more difficult than the solution I'm suggesting. And if you can get to fiscal consolidation, by all means, that's the first best. But if the first best is not attainable for political and many other reasons, then the second best should be this approach, which will internalize fiscal policy to individual countries and give individual countries both the flexibility and the discipline so that euro as a currency can continue as a viable currency zone.
We're going to go right here, this gentleman in the green shirt.
I have a question.
Can you identify yourself, please?
Yeah, my name is Ken Austin. I work for the Treasury Department. Some of these countries are actually very different, though. If you look at particularly the pre-bubble period and actually after, the U.S. and the U.K., a lot of the savings that were inflating the bubble were coming from overseas. Now, you talked about maybe Spain and Greece issuing debt that can only be bought by locals. A lot of these savings are coming in are actually directed by the Central Bank of China, which is buying U.S. reserve assets. Is that really a good thing for the U.S., or is it only likely to either blow up the bubble or create additional after the initial crisis begins? Does it just aggravate it by constituting a drag on aggregate demand?
Well, I don't want to defend the Chinese government in any way, but I don't think we can blame them for having a bubble here. They just bought U.S. Treasuries like anyone else. The people who took the money and did crazy thing with these toxic assets, AAA, garbage paper, those are all entirely the U.S. domestic actions. Had nothing to do with the Chinese, right? So I think
the availability of funds inside.
To some extent, yes. But the only thing they did is buying Treasury paper. And so how the money was cooked and played with, that was entirely U.S. domestic problem. And if you try to trying to blame the Chinese for buying U.S. Treasuries, do you really want them to sell? Certainly not at this instant. Possibly. But I know you're from the Treasury, so you can't accept. Okay. Because I think it's quite destructive for U.S.-China relations for U.S. to be blaming in such an indirect matter that because you bought our U.S. Treasuries and therefore we had these problems, because to them, they say, well, we just bought the safest paper on earth. We didn't create these crazy bubbles. We didn't invest in CDLs. We didn't invent the CDL. You guys did, not us. And I don't think that's a very productive way to go. Even though at margin, of course, Chinese action may have had little to do with lowering of interest rates more than where they might have been in the absence of Chinese purchases.
Gentleman in the front, and then we're going to take one more in the back.
Be quick. Robert Schroeder, President of International Investor. Really quick, back to your solution. Sometimes outright prohibitions or restrictions are difficult to pass, but what about the idea of, instead of focusing on spending, focusing on the revenue side? Could this be a tax incentive program rather than an outright prohibition? And are...
Prohibition?
Well, in other words, restricting people, restricting citizens only to that can purchase their own bonds. Perhaps a tax incentive program similar to our municipal bond program might be more in order and more easily passed. But my real question is, on the revenue side, is that completely off the table in your view? We're focusing completely on, you know, those who are focusing on cutting spending. You're suggesting we need more stimulus spending. Is it possible, even in that environment, to think about looking for other sources of revenue? I'm thinking about the financial transaction tax and some other proposals.
I am not a great fan of taxes in this particular instance because, first of all, if you have to compare government spending with tax cut, I definitely prefer government spending in this instance because private sector is minimizing debt. And if you give them a tax cut, they'll use to pay down debt instead of getting the economy going. So from that perspective, I much prefer seeing government spending the money so that you get the maximum bang for the budget deficit you have to incur. Now, for those economies, and Japan today is one of them, and Germany today is one of them, where balance sheet problems are already behind them. Japanese corporate balance sheets are probably the cleanest in the world, and so are the German balance sheets, because the Germans actually experienced balance sheet recession after their telecom bubble burst year 2000. But they managed to repair that balance sheets by 2005, 2006. They have a separate problem, and that is that after private sector goes through this period of debt repayment, they become so averse to borrowing money. And you might have heard that those Americans who lived through the Great Depression never borrowed money again until they died. The trauma is that bad. And when you are in that situation, tax incentives are the ones to get these guys to move forward, I think. So for Japan and for Germany, I think investment tax credit, the accelerated depreciation allowances, those are the measures that Japan and Germany should adopt. The kind of program the president introduced December of last year, that if you invest in year 2011, you can write off everything during the 2011. That probably won't do much good in the United States today because people are still repairing balance sheets. But the same program in Japan and Germany probably do a lot of good because balance sheets are all repaired. But what's left is the trauma. But this trauma could be very, very difficult to overcome. In fact, the fastest way to get the Japanese economy moving now is force everybody over 50 to retire. Then the younger kids who don't remember paying down debt will start maximizing profits tomorrow. But those people who remember paying down debt for 15 years, as you saw in my earlier charts, they are so fed up of that experience that they just refuse to borrow money. And for that, we need taxes and other incentives, not just government spending.
Okay, we're going to take one last question from the gentleman in the back.
Hideko Harris, I enjoyed your presentation. I hope you'll come back to get through the rest of your slides. It was great. I'm an international law consulting group. One quick question, observation. My sense is with your proposal that it would be practically impossible as a legal matter to shut that down on a national level. I just going through my head in terms of how the lawyers could just get around this, it strikes me almost impossible as a regulatory matter for you to really implement it, but something to consider. My real question is, it's the difference, you said, in a democracy, it's almost impossible to maintain this fiscal stimulus. One of the reasons it strikes me is because the capital markets seem to reward austerity. Both the debt and equity markets in the United States and in Europe seem to punish ongoing stimulus spending and reward austerity. And could you comment on that?
Well, I disagree with your second comment, because if that's the case, why is the bond yield in this country at these levels? When President Reagan was running the show, budget deficit in the United States was 6% of GDP at its highest point, and the bond yield was 14%. Today, the budget deficit is nearly 9% of GDP, 50% more as a percentage of GDP, and the bond yield is down to 2. So bond market is actually telling the U.S. government that this is time to increase the budget deficit, not decrease the budget deficit, because bond prices are now at the highest ever, record high, right? So that's a bond market's way of telling the government that this is no time to cut budget deficit. But when the bond yield is 14%, back in 1982 or 81, that means the bond prices at the lowest. That's bond market's way of telling the government that this is time to cut, not increase budget deficit.
You look at the equity markets, that's not been the case in the United States. If you look at the bond markets in Europe, that's not been the case.
And bond market in Europe is definitely not the case for the reasons I mentioned, because even if the money is available, the money flows to different markets. And I think equities are responding to the fact that the economy itself is not doing very well. I mean, with unemployment rate of 9% and all these problems, local governments and so forth, I don't think you could be particularly confident that the economy will be strong anytime soon. So I think this is all consistent. Now, you mentioned about the legal problems of restricting these flows. Well, of all the other possibilities, including fiscal integration or unification, I think this is of the least cost method of making euro work. And as mentioned earlier by this gentleman, that even in the U.S., we have these incentives for local people to buy local bonds. This is just one version of it in a slightly different form. The government can only sell to its own people, or that means that their own people can only buy your own government bond or U.S. Treasuries or JGBs, but not other bonds of Eurozone countries. And I am not against French banks buying Greek corporate paper. That should be allowed. Only government bonds. So all the gains that Eurozone is supposed to produce by enlarging capital market, increasing the depth of capital market, those will be all maintained, because private sector flows should be completely free of restrictions. Only government bonds. The limits should be only on holdings of government bonds. Now, some people might still set up, as you might have suggested, that someone will set up a company in Germany and the money is actually coming from Greece or somewhere, and then this German government will start buying bonds. You know, something like that is possible, but they have to bear the consequences. The German company that is buying will bear the consequences. So if something goes wrong, that's their problem. No one else should be involved in this thing to if something goes wrong.
Great. With that, I'd like to give a round of applause to Mr. Koo for this fascinating presentation.